and welcome to the PEDS Centered Podcast. I'm your host, Michelle Alatag, and today I'm chatting with Dr. Antonia Chiesa, who's an associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Colorado. Dr. Chiesa is board certified in pediatrics and child abuse medicine and is the director of integrated healthcare services at the Kemp Center for Prevention and Treatment of Child Abuse and Neglect in Denver, Colorado. Thanks for joining us, Antonia.
Thanks for having me.
So I'd like to start with some basics and just getting a feel for the scope of the problem. And we'll keep it to the United States specifically. How frequent is child abuse in the United States? And can you roughly break that down into physical, sexual, emotional, and neglect?
Sure. Well, there's actually some good news that I think a lot of people are not aware of. And that is, generally speaking, rates of child abuse, all forms that are monitored, are declining. And that appears to be consistent over probably a couple of decades now. And the most recent report generated from the Center of Crimes Against Children Research Center has shown that even rates of neglect are declining, which in previous years had remained relatively steady. And so we've seen about a 20% decline in neglect over the last 40 years, roughly, and way more dramatic declines in physical abuse and sexual abuse, about 64% for physical abuse and 63% for sexual abuse. And for a while, we weren't entirely sure those stats were accurate, but over the years, we've really been able to demonstrate that those are true declines in maltreatment. So that's really good news.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. We don't exactly know why. It's probably...
That's going to be my next question. Why is that happening?
Yeah. It's probably a combination of things like better recognition, improved services for families that minimize risk factors. There's some really exciting new data that's kind of come up as the result of this unanticipated experiment in the pandemic, that really simple things like economic benefits, things that are designed to address other issues, have this wonderful secondary effect of impacting mainly rates of neglect. Mm-hmm. So things like increased tax credits for early childhood income tax credits, things like Medicaid expansion, income supplements, parental leave, for example, all these sort of things tend to move the needle for rates of neglect for all the reasons that are, you know, pretty obvious. Keeping kids out of poverty probably reduces rates of reporting for neglect.
I have to say I have a sort of a unique lens because I live in a different country but work in the U.S. And here where I live in Costa Rica has very low rates, but they have a very strong emphasis in preventive care, social programs, availability of childhood education and care. And so while it's a poor country overall and spends maybe 15% in healthcare costs of what, you know, per capita the US does, everything is focused on prevention and on the front end, making sure that basic needs are met no matter how poor you are. Because I think a third of people who live here are technically, you know, under the poverty line, but nobody's starving. Nobody's worried about having a roof over their heads. And they know that they can send their kids to school and they can get healthcare because that's all that base level provided for it. So it doesn't surprise me to hear that, you know, we're seeing these basic kind of social safety nets making a big impact.
Right. So basic needs are a big thing to target when it comes to, as we mentioned, neglect. But I imagine in Costa Rica, there are probably cultural components, too, around families knowing that it's okay to ask for help or having extended family members available and nearby to help out.
Yes.
Maybe even attitudes towards children and caretaking that might also influence rates of maltreatment. And all of those issues are things that we're really focusing on nowadays in terms of supporting protective factors to help address child abuse and not just focusing on risk factors, for example.
Yeah. So I think that leads really nicely into what I was wanting to ask next is that there are a lot of cultural variations in different regions of the country or even, you know, small pockets really in the United States where a very diverse country. How do the definitions of child abuse or sort of the mentality about child abuse vary across the U.S.? And I'll give an example. I grew up in the South. I think you did too.
Yes.
And so at school, I remember we had paddles in the principal's office kind of starting in middle school, maybe in elementary school. I don't remember that. But it was, and still today, it is very much a culture of if it doesn't leave a mark when you beat your kids, that is fine. Totally within, you know, play. My husband, however, is from the Northeast and was totally appalled when I told him about this and asked me, well, didn't they just do detention? So it's, you know, it's funny how something that was totally normal for my culture was absolutely abhorrent to him just because we lived in different regions of the country. So how do people sort of define child abuse? Are there concrete definitions that apply everywhere? And then how do we navigate that sort of cultural gray zone of what is and what isn't?
Right. That is a really complex question. And there are probably several issues contained within the question. So
yeah, and you have 3 minutes to answer. So go ahead.
I really have 3 minutes.
No, I'm just kidding.
So it's probably important to distinguish that there are definitions that the medical community or pediatrics would use to define child abuse. And then there are statutory or legal definitions, which are different.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the issue of physical discipline or corporal punishment, which I could come back and do an entire other podcast on because it's really a fascinating story, if you ask me. But basically speaking, there aren't great, you know, general definitions. There are a lot of different definitions. They probably all sort of say the same around, you know, for example, sexual abuse of a child really is a spectrum of behaviors and activities. It's not just touching the child. It could be exploiting them or exposing them to inappropriate material, for example.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, from my point of view, when I think about making a diagnosis of physical abuse, I'm thinking about a caregiver who inflicts an injury on a child and then leaves something that I can see, like a bruise or a more severe injury. That's probably because most statutory definitions are similar. So in every single state in the U.S., a caregiver is allowed to strike their child. But you've hit on an important distinction. Most of those laws distinguish between leaving a mark and not leaving a mark.
Mm-hmm.
Neglect, it gets a lot grayer. And this is a big controversy in our field right now. A lot of people, and I'm in the camp, are saying that, you know, what we often look at in terms of neglect substantiations are probably kids who really don't belong in that category, kids who shouldn't be involved in the child welfare system, kids who people are probably confusing with poverty.
Yeah.
And so that's a big area where we're trying to sort out how can we keep those kids out of child welfare, figure out other systems that can help and support them, like our prior conversation, not really think of them in that poverty or neglect lens. And then there's the issue of physical discipline within the school system. And so, yes, there are certain states, I think last time I looked, it was like maybe 19 or 20 states that still allow physical discipline in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
There is a really interesting study that the Department of Education Office of Civil Rights puts out, not every year, maybe every 5 or 6 years, where they document the cases. And it is really interesting. It won't surprise you that it looks like discipline is meted out in a very disproportionate way.
Mm-hmm.
And even the Secretary of Education years ago said, you know, we need to stop this. This should not go on. But unfortunately, it's still legal in a lot of states. And I think a lot of people would say, you know, they're advocates of it. The history of physical discipline for kids, I won't go into too much, but just to say that it is very cultural. The science is, you know, it's not super hard and fast, but generally speaking, it shows that physical discipline isn't all that effective. It might help kids be more compliant in a short time frame, but overall, it really isn't a very effective method of discipline. But what's also interesting is that studies that have been done more recently, for parents that do use physical discipline, when you ask them, they say that they would prefer another method.
Mm-hmm.
But frustrated.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And so a lot of people have said, you know, it's time to stop this, right? Because in the U.S., if another adult assaults another adult, it's a crime or it's not allowed. And yet somehow we have this cultural context where it's okay to basically hit a child. You know, it's not just spanking. It's hitting. And so, you know, there's an interesting history of child's rights. The U.S. is one of the few countries that has not ratified the Child's Rights Declaration that really has also called for the end of corporal punishment. So, but there is a cultural context that we can't ignore. And I was having this conversation because, you know, again, some studies have shown like it's more common for boys or more common with aggressive behaviors, more common in African-American communities. And I was having this conversation with an African-American friend who said, you know, you got to be really cautious around some of the judgment that might be implied in these discussions, because for some African-Americans, compliance and behavior has higher stakes, right? Because if they send their kid out the door and their kid acts out in a way that a white kid might, the implications or stakes might be higher for that African-American child. So it's a really interesting conversation. And people ask me a lot, like after I give a talk, they're like, oh, I was disciplined as a child. And am I going to turn out okay? And of course, everything is contextual, right? Your parents may use physical discipline, but if they balance that with a lot of love and nurturing, you know, kids are going to do just fine.
Yeah, and culturally, it's, again, I'll tie it back to Costa Rica. It's kind of funny here. There's been a change. So it was never severe corporal punishment, but the corporal punishment involved your sandal. There's a lot of use of the chancleta. And there are memes and jokes, and everybody kind of jokes around about this, right? But were people traumatized? I don't know. There's a lot of humor about it. And there's a lot of joking, and it almost is like a funny symbol that people look back on. I don't know how traumatic it was.
There's a context and it's probably a lack of stigma because everyone got the shoe.
Yeah, right.
We use spanking a lot in the U.S., but in other countries, there are absolutely more accepted forms of different types of, like slapping across the face is really common. Some societies actually shake more than others. So it kind of depends.
That can be great. So let's talk about sentinel injuries, because those, I feel like, do fall into a little bit more hard and fast. There's not really a cultural gray zone with these and kind of defining those. And we've made more strict medical definitions, I feel like, over the years about these. They're super tough to identify. But I feel like the research focus within the emergent setting has really moved towards that and identifying things early, because you can intervene early as opposed to abusive head trauma, where it's really sort of too late to do much. So now we have, you know, the 10... started off as 10-4 faces, now it's 10-4 faces P. Can you talk about the 10-4 faces P rule and approximate sensitivity and specificity? And then just for listeners, there is an article from 2023 that I'll reference in the comments section that gives the sort of absolute numerical breakdown for the acronyms. If you like that level of detail, I'll put that in for you guys.
Sure. Yeah, sentinel injuries are tough and they're not tough. They're tough because they're kind of hard to wrap your brain around the significance and how to deal with them in the moment. But generally speaking, the concept is pretty easy. So sentinel injuries are minor injuries that occur in children that are a red flag for rough handling. And we're really talking about non-mobile infants. So kids roughly under 6 months of age, even before kids start to sit up and tip over and bump their head, for example. But things like little tiny bruises of the cheek, the ear, frenulum injuries in babies, bruising in places that, well, let me back up. So generally speaking, bruises, you know, in young non-mobile infants are kind of the most important thing to consider. But other things like injuries are also obviously a problem. And so the issue with sentinel injuries is that they're often predate a more serious injury when we look back in studies retrospectively. So when we look at kids with more serious injuries, like abusive head trauma or fractures. About a third of the time, those kids will have had a minor injury that was recognized and ignored. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, sometimes that means ignored by a medical provider.
Yeah.
And so really, they're just a sign that something isn't going right, that someone's being too rough with the baby, and that, as you mentioned, is a really important time for intervention. Mm-hmm. And so that's the tricky part for the medical provider, because you're like, I know it feels like I'm blaming you and I'm going to get you in trouble, but really, I try to think about it as, gosh, now's the time to intercede, get you some help before something goes worse and we end up with a child who has a much more severe injury. And sometimes it's just really hard to see like a tiny little single bruise, like on the upper arm of a baby or cheek, and go, yeah, this is a big deal. And it's hard to convince parents or even police or social services, if, you know, who, depending on who you're reporting to, that it is a big deal, that non-malignants shouldn't be bruising at all, period. You know, or unless there's just a really good history of an accident that explains it. So that is important. You know, these are injuries that are unexplained and not like I dropped my baby or their big brother bonked him on the head with a toy or something.
Yeah. And I think that's an important distinction for us to remember is that, yeah, if there's a plausible story, then you're good. Like it can still be within this distribution on the body. But if the story makes sense, it really does need to make sense. Then you can say, okay, we're fine. You know, I was taught in training by a wonderful child abuse physician who was like, you know, keep your differential very broad when you see this. And, you know, I kind of look at it depending on the setting with the parents, how much I feel like they can kind of take. But there are some parents who will be like, look, this bruising is abnormal. I don't know what's causing it, but I need to check labs to make sure it's not leukemia. I need to make sure that there isn't like a bony problem that your baby was born with that we don't know about. I need to make sure that there isn't a nutritional problem or metabolic problem. This is why we're doing all of these things. And yes, one of the things that we are looking for is that this is caused by an injury. But let me tell you all the other things, and we don't have to go into a lot of detail, that I'm thinking about too, so that we really need to investigate this. All I know right here and now is that this is abnormal and we should be worried about it. I don't know. I find that goes pretty well for the most part. I've had, you know, an occasional backfire with that, and which sort of solidified my thought that it was in fact an abusive injury based on the way the parents reacted. And I don't think you can control that. I think we get worried about sort of controlling the room in the ED.
Absolutely.
Sometimes you're not gonna. So.
No. And when I talk to medical providers about how to talk to families about your concerns regarding abuse, I tell them, keep it objective. Mm-hmm. And I say, give them the little layperson mini lecture of what I'm giving you now about diagnosis, which is, here's an injury. We don't have an explanation. I've got to consider other things. And if I don't have an explanation, I've got to consider something else happened. So I kind of tell them my diagnostic process in mm-hmm. terms they can understand, just like you very nicely described.
Yeah. And not everybody wants to hear that you're concerned that their child has leukemia either. So again, you dial it up or down based on kind of what your feel for, you know, how detailed they want. Because I have some families who they're like, oh, their thing and their mouth is torn and that's weird, so you have to go have them do this CAT scan. Okay. some people are like, oh, that's your protocol. That's fine. We're totally here's the baby. So I don't know. I think you can kind of gauge it, but I think there's a lot of angst on the part of really any mandated reporter. I know because I have family members who are teachers who feel this as well. And then EMS and then physicians and, you know, healthcare providers about, are we overcalling? What am I putting this family through? They're going to be super angry. I don't think we have a lot of control over that
in general. We don't, but we should remain objective. right? Mm-hmm. So if it's physical abuse, you should be talking about an injury without an explanation.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing I would counsel people about is, and I do hear this pretty often from providers, I just have this gut. That is not, your gut is not reliable. Mm-hmm. Your gut is not reliable. So we really need to be thinking objectively. And then when we see these injuries, we need to be doing the same thing for every child who presents with one of these injuries.
Yes.
Regardless of how nice the family is, or whether they're your neighbor, or what color mm-hmm. they are, or what kind of car they drive. So with these nice standardized screening protocols that are evidence-based, if we stick to those and we're consistent with every child that we see with these injuries, that is kind of an antidote against our bias creeping in and deciding to do these only for certain kids or certain families.
Well, and I worked for a long time with one of your colleagues who did some cross coverage for the ED. And she and I both talked about, we were like, why she and I both have this, I don't know, I don't think it's really an attribute, but like, we have a really great spidey sense. Like, we can stand in a room with somebody and just know. Like, I mean, and I think we talked about this one time when I was in with, there was a child with abusive head trauma. There was no question about what was going on, but everybody was sort of focused on the dad. The police were talking to the dad. The nurses were like, this dad, you know, and I walked into the room and I walked out and I was like, it's the grandma. Like, I just knew. But it doesn't matter, right? Because that's not our job. My job is not to say it's the grandma, it's the dad, it's whoever, whatever. My job is to say this falls into the pattern that is determined to be abnormal. And I need to do this workup for that because I don't have a story that the child fell into a pole on their mouth with a picture of it, and that's why they're missing some teeth and have a frenulum tear. You know, if it falls into the range that I need to work up, then I'm going to do it every time. And it doesn't matter what I feel about dad or mom or grandma.
Right. And as someone who's been doing this a long time, I've had those feelings too. I totally know what you mean. It does feel like the more experience you have, I do think there is that sort of gray skill that it's hard to define and is probably real. But I've also had that feeling, felt pretty convinced and then been wrong, right? So we all we can do is rely on what we can study, which is, it's hard to study the gut feeling. And so we have to go with what we do know. And every single state has mandatory reporting laws. Again, that's an area of controversy in our field right now, whether that's something that should exist. But healthcare providers in every state are mandatory reporters. And mm-hmm. so you kind of have to report because it's currently the law. Now, in my state, in Colorado, the law doesn't really give you a lot of guidance. It just says a reasonable suspicion of abuse. And so there is discretion on the provider's part to determine, you know, what that reasonableness is. And so that's where it can get tricky. But generally speaking, for physical abuse, it's like, does the injury match the history? It's really that thing.
Yeah. And with angry parents, I do fall back on, I don't know, maybe it's just using excuses, but I fall back on the law. So again, yeah, I have to report this because it's a law, or I'll have, you know, teenagers where they're like, why do you separate my child to ask them questions about teenager things? I'm like, because it's the law. I have to. Why won't you tell me about their STD? Go vote if you don't like how it is. This is the law. I have to follow the rules or I could get in major trouble. So I fall back on that a fair amount when I have families who are unhappy with the level of workup or the reporting that's going to happen.
It's the last part of that little mini lecture I give the families. I don't mean lecture, you know, wagging your finger lecture. I mean the little...
Your spiel. Yeah.
The med-ed lecture of, okay, here's a history. Doesn't really match this injury because I'm a mandatory reporter. The law requires me to call this to either police or social services. So mm-hmm. I do it every time.
Can you talk a little bit about stating that upfront versus evasiveness with it? So sometimes in order to not have a situation blow up or people leave the ED AMA, people will want to avoid saying those things. How do you navigate giving that information or not?
No, we're very transparent with our families. That's another thing I tell them. I'm very transparent with you. I wouldn't tell social services something that I'm not telling you as well. I do save it towards the end because, again, I want to be objective. When I go to do my assessment, I'm starting with that blank slate, or as your mentor said, keeping my differential broad. So I go in and I'm not going to jump to a conclusion of abuse. I do a really thorough history because I'm still a pediatrician at heart. And I do a complete history and physical and social history, family history, so that I can consider, are there other things that I am missing or that I should think about, like leukemia? And so in the case of bruising, for example. So, yeah, I mean, I'm trying to be objective in my information gathering. I think hopefully that demonstrates to families that I'm open-minded. And then once I've kind of narrowed it down, then I also kind of explain that, just like you mentioned, you know, I've thought about these other things. I've tested X, Y, or Z. The history doesn't fit these this other category of things. And so now I am kind of getting to the point where I do think this is trauma. I often say, this looks like something happened to your child. This isn't a medical disease. And so when I see trauma on the body without an explanation, that's where I worry something else could have happened, including could have been hurt by a family member. And that's what I'm worried about and have to report. So I do kind of save it towards the end, but I'm pretty open about it. Again, explaining my diagnostic process along the way, hoping that objectivity brings some element of balance to a tough conversation that probably feels very unbalanced to the family.
And again, we've both been doing this for a while, so I can list off many examples of rickets or congenital syphilis or several leukemia, unfortunately for me, that I've seen that have come in with concern for child abuse. And so, again, depending on the parents, I will sometimes give examples, like very specific examples of kids who I've seen just like yours, and this is what we need to look at. Sometimes I find that that's helpful too.
Yeah, that's neat. I've never done that. It's a good idea.
And again, it's not a scare tactic. I'll tell them. I'm not trying to scare you. The chances of that are low, but it's, you know, something that I've seen. And so this is why we do all of these things that seem like a lot for something very little.
Right, right.
A little bit more specific question about your diagnostic process. What is your age cutoff for getting a CT head in kids who come in with these sentinel injuries? Because I've seen a lot of variation in protocols and feel like the literature on that has changed a bit over the years too.
The textbook answer is under one. But honestly, I think the literature needs to catch up a little bit. A lot of folks in our field would tell you under 6 months of age, for sure, no question, do it. Between 6 months and a year, I think there is some discretion, could depend on the type of other injury that you're seeing. If it's a broken arm and a 9-month-old, I still tend to image the head, a slap mark across the face or a frenulum tear that suggests, you know, there was trauma to the head. It's going to tip him over a little bit more. So generally speaking, no question, under 6 months of age, do it. Between 6 months and a year, if the exam is, you know, really stone cold, normal, and we're talking about like a grab mark to the leg, I think a lot of child abuse pediatricians would say it's okay not to image, or at least consider not imaging. People worry about radiation to the head. It's a real concern, but so is missing serious forms of child abuse. And so that's also life-threatening and maybe more immediate concern.
Yeah.
Couple of other thoughts along those lines. There's increasing use of MRI, which will save radiation for children. I know not every institution can do these studies. It's not just any MRI either. It's the what we call FAST or shunt series.
Yeah, quick brain.
Quick brain, right. And so they're fast. They don't require sedation. You can swaddle a baby and feed them so they don't move pretty effectively. Those are pretty good at picking up intracranial hemorrhage, for example, parenchymal injury. You can miss a skull fracture with MRI versus CT, but I think people are increasingly use those. For a kid who I'm really worried about significant trauma, I go with CT because of that risk of missing a skull fracture, but more and more, I've seen people even using the fast MRI to screen for kids who present with acute injuries.
How does your thought process change when you're talking about burns versus bruises?
Burns are especially important to be thinking about pattern and history. So most burns that we see are inflicted from hot water, but not always. You know, sometimes kids are branded or hurt with an implement. Sometimes kids have chemical burns. So it really, you know, kind of, there tends to be often a lot more history to navigate with a burn.
Yeah.
Patterns of burns from water that are abusive tend to be very symmetric in terms of the distribution, but also depth. And they tend to have really abrupt or clear demarcations in terms of the boundaries of the burn. We often refer to stocking or glove type burns where a child's hand or foot is forcibly held in standing water or held underwater so that the distribution of where a sock or a glove would go is burned in a really specific pattern. That being said, there are a ton of accidental burns out there, and those usually are a little bit different. Often they're the result of water flowing over the body part, so the pattern is different, or a quick contact with the water, so the patterns aren't as homogeneous in terms of the depth and distribution. So they tend to be like, you know, a little bit of partial thickness over here, full thickness over here, sparing in other places, or splash marks present. So burns are not necessarily something I think of as a sentinel injury because they are more severe, kind of in that more severe category.
Yeah. But
they are a common type of skin injury that we see from abuse, and you really have to be able to get that good history and help distinguish the accident versus inflicted. And also, the other thing about burns that's kind of nice is you can get additional information, for example, if you end up reporting it from the people who are able to go to the scene and say, you know, in the case of an abusive burn, for example, oh, yeah, you know, the hot water really doesn't get that hot, or there was a dirty diaper in the trash can that maybe was a trigger, you know, in terms of a pottying accident or something. So scene information can be helpful for burns in particular.
Yeah. And I'll just put out there for a lot of places, the resource of having a child abuse specialist or a burn specialist on site who can actually see your patients in real time is not available. So pictures are immensely helpful in that setting, both in the moment, because you can then call your resource wherever they may be, even if it's not within your health system, if you're calling, you know, the nearest academic children's hospital, you can send those to them in the moment and they can give you your opinion, or you can document these again for sort of future reference. Because I do try to remember that not all of us have you on call to ask, and we're navigating these kind of on our own.
Right. Most places don't have what you just described. So I love the EMR for that reason. Increasingly, we're using pictures, and I think it's super helpful.
Yeah, I agree. Can you talk just a little bit more, just because I kind of try to, I like to talk about hopeful things in all of our specialties, because pediatric medicine, I feel like, is still making a lot of strides and a lot of advances. And we get caught up, especially in the emergent setting, with the failures and the things that are going wrong, because that's what we're seeing. But can you talk about some of the positive outcomes? You started off with talking about abuse rates and neglect rates going down in the United States. But I know that you do a lot of work with the Kemp Center about just, again, helping families and children become healthier and raising healthy, happy kids, which I think is really important in this era of kids who are struggling so much with mental health. what interventions are working? What have you seen that has made a positive impact, especially on families who are presenting with things like sentinel injuries or just coping difficulties with parenting in general?
Well, I do think this is a really interesting part of our work that is really changing right now. And that's less of a focus on adversity and really thinking about what are the positive influences that can decrease abuse across society. And so the initial work was really important, the work of Felitti and ACEs, or Adverse Childhood Experiences, back in the 90s, where we finally were able to establish that, hey, adversity in early childhood is bad. It leads to bad adult outcomes that are bad for society. Hopefully everyone knows that.
Yeah.
And the mechanism there was toxic stress, right? But that was really a focus on the problem. And so in the ensuing decades, the research has really turned towards, well, what's the solution, right? We know why toxic stress is so bad for you, but what actually is the antidote? And it appears that it's probably positive, safe, stable, nurturing relationships in a child's life. So there's some individual and relational factors that are really important, but also calling attention to the community and society factors that can also address this. So it's not just a family or child issue. There are things that we can do in that social ecological model that are really going to help. And so the packaging of this research, it comes in a lot of different flavors. Safe, stable, nurturing relationships comes from work from the CDC and the framework of early childhood. There's a great program that's been started called HOPE, and I can't recall the entire acronym, but Dr. Bob Siege is a child abuse pediatrician who developed HOPE, and it's really around positive experiences. That's the P and the E of HOPE. You know, there are other ways that other folks have looked at it in terms of not just ACEs, positive childhood experiences. So it's really great that we're now focusing on what can we do to make things right. And so that's really a great lesson that we've learned. And there are a lot of different things. It's not rocket science. It's stuff like, you know, making sure that you have an adult that you trust and you can go to if you have a question or a concern, or that if a parent is struggling, that they have somewhere where they can go for help, or that the child has a safe community that has a grocery store and a park in space. And there's safe childcare, for example, that we have, you know, good schools and social safety nets that help protect the most vulnerable in society.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you say things like green space. And I have to say, I had very limited appreciation for the benefit of that until living in Colorado, where, well, and, you know, really not throughout the whole state, so you see differences. But in the Denver metro area, every neighborhood has a park that is within a couple of blocks of every person. It does not matter what neighborhood you're in. And made a difference. I mean, it was a very real, palpable difference having green space, having the ability to walk around in your neighborhood. And, you know, we sort of intellectually think of these things, but to actually witness it and witness people in all neighborhoods out in the park, exercising, doing things, it's good for general health. People were more active. I always sort of joked that, you know, Colorado wasn't necessarily a great place to train because everybody was so healthy.
I agree.
You didn't see really terrible, bad disease like you do, you know, in some other places that I've worked. But it makes a huge impact. And there are places within that state that don't have that. And the difference is remarkable.
Right. It is. And it's great to think, you know, these sound so easy. And again, I love that some of these things that help address parenting and child abuse, really no one's probably thinking about when they do it, like creating a new park or having paying your taxes to have a great park system in your city. But what's important is that, you know, we're probably never going to completely get rid of adversity. Unfortunately, we're probably never going to completely get rid of child abuse. But the other piece of the puzzle is that these positive influences moderate when you do experience the bad stuff. So when you look at studies of kids who have the same number of adversities, but then you measure and compare those who also have positive influences versus the kids with only adversity and no positive influences, the kids who have some of those positive influences do better, right? So these are mediators of stress. And it makes sense. Like if I have a rough day and I'm exhausted, but I say, go outside, get some sun and take a walk, I actually feel better.
Yeah.
If I just stayed really stressed in the house and, you know, go put on my pajamas and sit in front of the TV.
Yeah. And it's been fascinating to sort of watch this over a career where the questions have really changed. So for a long time, the main focus that from my lens I saw, because I read a limited amount of child abuse literature, but the focus was a lot of the question of, do we remove the child from the home? Do we not remove the child from the home from a standpoint of management as opposed to diagnosis? And I always thought this is the wrong question to be asking because there are problems either way, right? Like, which is safer, choice A or choice B? Is there choice C? Is there something else that can be done? And it was the pendulum swinging from let's remove all the kids and put them in foster care to let's remove none of the kids because foster care is bad. And it was just swinging back and forth. I mean, I feel like you lived this too. So I love that there's a movement more towards thinking a little bit broader picture than that.
There is still very much a movement to think about, are there alternatives to solutions for foster care? And when I say foster care, what I really mean is taking a kid out of their community, out of their family, and placing them with a stranger.
Mm-hmm.
That is a huge conversation in our field. And most medical providers are really unaware of this conversation, and they're unaware that there are people out there who think we should completely abolish the foster care system, maybe even abolish many components of child welfare in general. I think it's a good discussion to be had. Right now, there isn't another solution to child welfare, and so I'm not necessarily in that camp, but I do think we need to recognize that there are major downsides to taking a child away from things that are familiar to them, even abusive things that are familiar to them, as crazy as that sounds. And we know that kids who go into the foster care system, the outcomes for them are not great. And so we really need to think of alternatives. And so by and large, most child welfare systems are doing this, I think, are trying to highly prioritize keeping a child either in the home or in the home with supports, or at least within kin, either someone that is related to them or someone that isn't not necessarily blood related, but familiar and close to them and still connected to their community. That appears to be the best way to handle it. But that is still a big area of controversy. And then thinking about what is the least aggressive way that child welfare can be implemented, including all of these supportive things that can happen.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that falls into a similar camp to least restrictive environment for kids with disabilities. Like what is the most normative thing that we can do for these kids? And I think, I feel like we worry about that on both extremes within the emergent setting when we're seeing these kids and there's, you know, a safety plan being put into place and they can't leave our ED until there is one. And I think there are cases where we can't believe that they're not removing this kid and what are they thinking and what are they doing and what is going to happen. And that causes a lot of anxiety for us when we, you know, we don't see the downstream process. So we don't really know what's happening. All we know is that we're pretty sure that this kid's being sent home with their abuser because that's been the decision that's made. On the other extreme, there's the, I can't believe they're ripping this child from their home. And so we kind of fall both ways, but there's a lot of angst, I think, because we don't see the follow-up.
Totally agree. It's so hard. And I mean, we need to give ourselves a little bit of of grace here, because we probably are seeing the worst of the worst. You know, if a kid is so bad that they're in the hospital, it's probably not a very good situation. So, and we come at this with a really kind of appropriate bias, right? We're pediatric experts. So we got into this because we want to help kids.
Mm-hmm.
That's a bias we probably need to be aware of, because it's not just the kid, right? It's the family, and kids probably do better when they're considered part of their family. So it's an understandable bias. We just need to check it sometimes and have, I would say, if you don't have faith in your system, get more involved in your system. So be the person in your system that the caseworker can actually reach on the phone, or be the person who writes a note that's so detailed enough that it can't be ignored. It doesn't have to be blaming or subjective. You shouldn't say this kid should never go to this family, but you clearly outline what you're worried about and not just say bruise and then leave it at that. Be that person in your community who, you know, calls in the report and has the direct conversation instead of leaving it to someone who never saw the kid or is the person answering the phone in your ER. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff that we can do that we are in control of that can help make things better, right? And so instead of just jumping to making a report for a kid maybe who is under-resourced, you're worried about neglect, think about how your system can handle that. Like, can your social worker or health navigator speak to the family and get them connected to a food bank or get them a card or a jacket instead of relying on child welfare to do that? So I get it. There are times where I feel frustrated and out of control. And then there are times when our system probably could have done better.
Yeah.
And at least been more active in the part that we have influence over.
And I have learned over the years to give my opinion when it's asked for. And if I don't feel comfortable with the plan, calling and having a direct conversation. And I, you know, I'll often say, hey, I'm going to take off my doctor hat for a minute and I'm going to put on my mom one until you admit, you know, I really think that this family just needs some therapy and needs to talk about this and maybe talk about some parenting strategies with their teenager, because having a teenager is, I mean, you have teenagers, I have a teenager. It is hard to parent teenagers. And if you come at it already with stressors and maybe not the best coping skills, it can be really hard. So I don't have a problem with sort of giving some recommendations when I'm talking with child services and say, you know, this is kind of what I think. But I have also learned to let go of the fact that they may not agree with me and that is, you know, their part to play and I have played mine.
And I think sometimes it's also okay to say, I don't know what the answer here, but here's what I'm worried about. And like, I think it just needs more assessment, you know? And then you're not putting yourself in their role. You're just having a really important professional discussion. And when I talk to child welfare, I'm also often emphasizing how hard this work is. Why would any one person or profession want to take on the burden of this work? It really is so complicated that I think it's best when we all put our heads together, and that different perspectives are going to bring different, you know, ideas. And so I really am a fan of that multidisciplinary approach, but it's challenging because sometimes our systems are super siloed and we're not talking and sharing information like I think is appropriate.
Yeah, I'm actually really thrilled with one of the hospital systems that I'm currently working at. Actually, they require that we do the reporting personally. It cannot be passed off to anybody else. We are the ones. And if I recall, it's actually a state law. It's not that this was mandated by the state. Like, so it has to be you having that conversation. I actually find that it's quite valuable because I'm able to give more direct input about here's the reason why I'm concerned about this specific thing. Here's the reason why I'm not concerned about this other thing. And here's sort of where we are from my perspective. Because otherwise, yeah, you're relying on notes or a game of telephone. And maybe you're calling the social worker who may or may not be able to meet with the family in person, or maybe they're talking to them on the phone, or worst case, we're just routing it to your clinic And you have to follow up on that, you know, the next week, which is also not ideal, but is a way things are done sometimes. So yeah, I do like that. You know, if you have a few minutes, take the time, give your, you know, we are experts. We do have expert opinions, but understand that it is that, you know, it's the opinion of somebody in the ED and it's going to be taken into account, but it may not be, you know, the end all decision-making process.
Making a report is an art, right? You definitely need to give them enough objective information that they understand why you're reporting, balance really that subjectivity with kind of objective findings. It's okay to say, yeah, like you don't want to just say, oh, this is an unexplained bruise. You need to make the connection. This is an unexplained bruise. I'm concerned it's, you know, minor physical abuse or something like that. But but I love that idea of what you just described, because it really is about how we can improve, you know, communication. And that I think is so important.
I was actually very put off by it at first. And then I did my first call and was like, oh no, this is better. Because usually I'm only calling if I'm really vehemently in disagreement with what the plan is. And I'm like, oh, this is a much nicer conversation when I'm talking to people just all the time, as opposed to only when I'm really angry about something. And it gives, again, it gives a fuller and better picture. So
absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. I think with that, we will wrap up. Thank you so much for talking with me.
I appreciate it. I love it. I love it. It's so cool.